To Jackson, Lincoln had launched a war of aggression against sovereign states. That was why he fought, why he believed that God could not possibly be on the side of the aggressor. The Northern response to John Brown's raid had proven beyond a doubt the North's malign intent. Now, finally, soldiers were coming. "Had Lincoln not made war upon the South, Virginia would not have left the Union," wrote William Thomas Pogue, who would fight as a gunner under Jackson, and whose view was typical of Virginians in the war. The North was the aggressor. The South resisted her invaders. History will vindicate her course. Chapter 3. Fate Intervenes. They traveled north, 38 rough miles through the green brilliance of the Shenandoah Spring, through drifts of dogwood blossoms so thick they looked like snow on the ground. At Stanton, they took a special train east, crossing the Blue Ridge Mountains, and then dropping down across the river and stream-crossed plateau of the Piedmont Country, watching as the flawless farms, timbered hillsides, and swelling meadows floated by in the windows of the train. Though none of them could have known it then, this was one of the last glimpses they would ever get of the Old South, a place as yet unvexed by war and unmarked by the ravages of sprawling, rapacious armies. That was all to come. Soon it would be impossible to find even a small corner of Virginia that had not been deeply scarred. When Major Thomas J. Jackson and his 176 charges arrived on the night of April 22, 1861, Richmond, a steepled brick city of 40,000 that rose sharply from the banks of the James River, was already in the embrace of this great change. The city, in fact, was swarming with recruits. They had been streaming in day and night since Virginia's secession. They were conspicuous for their almost complete lack of understanding of military methods and protocols, their fondness for alcohol, their idiosyncratic and often brilliantly colored uniforms, their plumed and sashed commanders, and the atrocious and obsolete weapons they carried, when they carried them at all. Many had ancient smoothbore flintlocks that literally could not have hit a barn door at 50 paces. Some carried butcher knives, as though those might be enough to frighten the Yankees back to Maine or Ohio. They were undiscouraged. They marched and countermarched, bivouacked where they could, and looked for someone in authority who could somehow make sense of all this, or tell them where they ought to go. Into this happy swirl of confusion came Jackson and his cadets, arriving unheralded at the Richmond station. They were desperately needed. Soldiering, as it turned out, was all about drilling and discipline and such inconveniences as adherence to a strict schedule. The cadets, as it happened, knew something about these things. The usual repository of such skills, the militias, were relics of a bygone era, more like social clubs than functioning military units. Though they were supposed to perform 3 perfunctory drills a year, few did even that. Jackson delivered his charges to the Virginia authorities, who put them briefly on review, then put them immediately to work instructing the new recruits. They were just boys, really, but they looked crisp and soldierly and possessed specialized knowledge that was suddenly critical to the war effort, often to the annoyance of the volunteers and militiamen, many of whom saw indignity in the whole idea. To get up at dawn to the sound of fife and drum, to be drilled by a fat little cadet young enough to be my son of the Virginia Military Institute, that indeed was misery, wrote a 33-year-old recruit. How I hated that little cadet. The cadets would eventually train some 15,000 recruits that year in Richmond. Having done his duty, Jackson was now curiously adrift, without a command. No new orders had awaited him on his arrival. No one in authority had any immediate plans for him. This was despite the fact that of 1,200 West Point graduates who were fit for military service at the beginning of 1861, only 300 were in the South, and thus in great and immediate demand in a new country that was planning to repel an invader. Overlooked, too, were Jackson's regular Army credentials. 4 years in the service, including a brief distinguished stint in the Mexican-American War, that ought to have been highly valued in the chaotic proto-military world of Richmond. Jackson left no record of his reaction to this apparently deliberate oversight, though he cannot have been pleased. It appeared that in some parts of the Southern hierarchy, anyway, his reputation as an eccentric martinet had preceded him. While he harbored plenty of ambition and earnestly believed he could help the Confederacy's war effort, he was not the sort of man to push himself on state politicians. He knew that the estimate formed of his powers by the major part of the people and the authorities was depreciatory, acknowledged his friend and later chief of staff, Robert Louis Dabney, but he disdained to agitate or solicit for promotion. His fate, he believed, was in God's hands, as was the whole of this incomprehensible war, and he preferred to leave it that way. Jackson managed to make himself useful anyway. Duty was duty, after all. He volunteered to be an artillery drill master, joining other former U.S. Army officers on a training ground at Richmond College. His immediate supervisor was the flamboyant John B. Magruder, who had been Jackson's commander in the Mexican-American War. For the next 2 days, Jackson, rejoined by 12 of his cadets, instructed recruits in the rudiments of artillery. But there was no getting around it. Jackson was, for the moment, lost in the crowd. And a bumptious, jostling crowd it was in that unruly spring, jammed with self-seekers and self-promoters and name-droppers and people with political connections who were clamoring for colonelcies or captaincies or whatever they fancied. "He was not the recipient of any special attention," wrote one officer who met Jackson at camp. "He was very quiet and reticent, having little to say to anyone." Jackson's dress, especially amid the plumage of the militia officers, was plainly verging on shabby, starting with his weather-beaten cap. From its faded looks, it would be fair to judge that he bought it when he became a member of the faculty in 1851, wrote his friend John Lyle. His blue cloth coat had no advantage of the cap in smartness of appearance and was, no doubt, of the same age. A stranger would not have picked out the man in the faded blue uniform. In these early days, Jackson was the man everyone expected him to be. Plain, shy, tight-lipped, polite to everyone yet never eager to chat or make small talk. A modest man of apparently modest talents, who smiled but never laughed. In this uncertain state, he fended off his wife's offer to come and join him. "The scene here, my darling pet, looks quite animated," he wrote Anna on April 25, in an upbeat tone that almost certainly did not match his mood. "Troops are continually arriving. Yesterday about 700 came in from South Carolina. I received your precious letter, in which you speak of coming here in the event of my remaining. I'd like very much to see my sweet little face, but my darling had better remain at her own home, as my continuance here is very uncertain." Indeed, it was so uncertain, and his time so unoccupied, that at one point he spent the better part of the day teaching a raw recruit, a corporal of the guard, every detail of the man's new position, accompanying him through the whole circuit of sentry posts, patiently teaching him the various salutes and challenges, and instructing him in his duty. Jackson was not only unwanted and unneeded, he was bored, too. That same day, his orders finally came through. They were a crushing disappointment. They confirmed whatever feelings he had that he was being slighted. He had been made a major in Virginia's topographical engineers, an appointment that his wife said he found distasteful, which was probably a graceful understatement. It was more like an insult. That was first because Jackson was no engineer, a job that involved drawing, essentially the rendering of terrain, buildings, and fortifications. It had been his worst subject at West Point. Far worse was the implied lack of respect for him as a soldier. The job was likely to be behind a desk in Richmond rather than on the front lines, and at a time when colonelcies and field commands were being given out liberally to men with less experience or no experience at all, Jackson would now enter the Army at the same rank he had won by brevet 14 years before. As the great surge of war thrummed about him in the streets of Richmond, he was, in effect, being buried in a desk job for which he had little aptitude. Fortunately for Jackson, he was not the only one who saw the absurdity in placing someone with wartime experience behind a desk in a fledgling nation full of people who did not have the slightest idea how to fight a war. As it happened, an old friend from his childhood days in northwestern Virginia named Jonathan Bennett was working in Richmond as state auditor. Bennett had been surprised to hear about Jackson's assignment and took his concern immediately to Virginia Governor John Letcher, another Jackson friend from Lexington, where the former had practiced law. Letcher quickly intervened and by April 26 had secured for Jackson an appointment as colonel of the Virginia Volunteers. The next day he summoned Jackson to his office and announced what must have seemed an astounding turn of luck, giving Jackson what Jackson himself later said was the best possible appointment he could have received. Not only was it a colonelcy, he would soon receive orders to take command at Harper's Ferry, the northernmost outpost of the Confederacy, and a place of great strategic value that contained an armory and was located on one of the Union's key railroad lines. Jackson was elated. He left that night. Along the way, he received his actual orders from Major General Robert E. Lee, the ranking Army officer of the Confederacy. "You will proceed without delay to Harper's Ferry, Virginia, and assume command of that post," wrote Lee. "After mustering into the service of the state such companies as may be accepted under your instructions, you will organize them into regiments or battalions, uniting as far as possible companies from the same section of the state." Jackson already liked and admired Lee, and wrote Anna that he regarded him as a better officer than General Winfield Scott, the highest-ranking Union commander. Jackson had met both men in the Mexican-American War. The location of his assignment at the edge of the mountainous and Union-tilting northwestern section of the state, today it is the state of West Virginia, was not coincidental. Jackson, who had grown up in those mountains, had so many relatives there that, in Bennett's words, "almost every second man is his kinsman." In a directive to Letcher, Lee stated that great confidence is placed in the personal knowledge of Major Jackson in this regard. If deemed expedient, he can assemble the volunteer forces of the Northwest. Thus, Jackson's commission had been given him as much for political reasons as for any perceived notion of his military abilities. But there was nothing wrong with that. The early days of the war were a sort of golden age for political generals and colonels and other officers, men who were given appointments for the constituencies they represented or the allies they brought with them, and not for their military experience. The ranks of both sides were already full of them, and it would take several years to weed out the worst of them. Because he had been to West Point and had fought in Mexico, Jackson would never be grouped with such people. Still, he was seen as someone who might be politically useful in the western regions of Virginia. Either way, he got the job. It was a small event that would have astonishing consequences. Chapter 4, Discipline and Other Novel Ideas. The chaos Jackson found at Harper's Ferry was very like the chaos he had found at Richmond, with one important distinction. He was now in command of it. Here was the same motley assortment of volunteers and militiamen, the same raw-boned recruits with the same naive, self-fulfilling notions of what the war was going to be like, the same lack of order, the same wild exuberance. Some 2,500 men, mostly from the Shenandoah Valley, had assembled in the warming Appalachian spring in the tiny, picturesque mountain town on a tongue of land at the confluence of the Potomac and Shenandoah rivers. It was lovely, outsized country, broad-shouldered mountains falling abruptly into sparkling, muscular rivers. If this notch in the mountains seemed to the recruits a perfect place to have a sort of extended social picnic, punctuated with parades, they could hardly be blamed. There had been no one in the 2 weeks since secession to tell them otherwise. "Society was plentiful," wrote a young recruit who was there, "for the ranks were filled with the best blood of Virginia. All its classes were there. Mothers and sisters and other dear girls came constantly to Harper's Ferry, and there was little difficulty in seeing them. Nothing was serious yet. Everything much like a joke. In charge of all this were four generals of the militias, a colorful set of men even by the standards of the early war. They dressed the way they believed generals ought to dress, cocked hats and feathers, epaulets and ceremonial sashes, gleaming sabers and pistols. They looked quite grand, the more so since they went about like pashas, with entourages that included aides-de-camp, adjutants, inspectors general, personal servants, and various supernumeraries. They served whiskey liberally to friends and colleagues. They liked ceremony and spectacle and provided plenty of both. They owed their positions to their prominence in their hometowns and counties. The ranking officer, for example, 60-year-old Major General Kenton Harper, was the mayor of Stanton, Virginia, and the editor of the town's newspaper. He presided over what, by military standards, was an organizational disaster. There was no medical facility, no commissary or quartermaster, no chief of ordnance. The limit of military organization was the 100-man company. There was little equipment or ammunition, and many of the men had no rifles. But no one in command seemed terribly exercised about the shortages. Life rolled on, reviews were held, speeches made, and everyone seemed quite happy in anticipation of the excitement that was surely to come. Amid such pomp and visions of martial glory, the new commanding colonel, who arrived on the evening of April 27, was a sorry disappointment. He was, in fact, the opposite of anyone's idea of what a leader was supposed to look like, and his somber, uncourtly, and undashing manner did nothing to change that impression. He had only two assistants— Assistant Adjutant General John Preston, a personal friend, founder of VMI, and a leading businessman in Lexington, and Inspector General James Massey, a VMI faculty member. The new commander had no prancing steeds and not a thread of gold trim on his uniform. Bearded, solemn, and unexceptional, he walked with long, awkward strides through the camps, wearing his faded blue VMI uniform and a beaten-up cadet cap, that he pulled down so far over his nose that it obscured the upper part of his face. "The Old Dominion must be sadly deficient in military men if this is the best she can do," wrote one newspaper correspondent who spent some time with him. "He is nothing like a commanding officer." Jackson, meanwhile, felt exactly like a commanding officer. This was what he had wanted. And he believed without any doubt that he was equal to the task. He took a modest room at a little wayside hotel near the railroad bridge, where he sat with Preston at a small pine table, often under a tree in the yard, reviewing the rolls of troops. His self-assurance was immediately tested. On the day he arrived, Virginia Governor Letcher had informed state militias in Harper's Ferry and elsewhere that officers above the rank of captain would be relieved of duty the moment a state-designated commanding officer arrived. Jackson's first job was to enforce this order, which meant dismantling most of the military command structure in Harper's Ferry. Predictably, the idea that the imperial generals were being ousted in favor of this shabbily dressed, socially inept professor seemed disgraceful, both to the officers and to the men who served under them. The deposed officers left for home or for Richmond in a high state of indignation, wrote a member of a Stanton regiment. The men were deeply attached to their field officers and regarded the ordinance of the convention as an outrage on free men and volunteers. Jackson thus began his tenure in an atmosphere of outright hostility and insubordination. Many of the militia officers had stormed off to Richmond to plead their cases, unable to believe that it could possibly be in the interest of the state or the Confederacy to replace them. Some militiamen simply left in disgust. Jackson, unfazed by any of this public contempt, one of his great strengths and weaknesses was that he cared little about the opinion of others, now moved quickly to reorganize the troops. He began by asking some of the militia officers to stay and help him, thus buying goodwill with a number of companies. Working late into the night and sometimes through until morning, his one complaint to his wife in otherwise happy letters was his lack of sleep, He slowly but firmly stripped the militia companies of their independence and hammered them together into regiments, recruiting many VMI graduates into command positions. He got rid of the whiskey and instituted a rigorous and unforgiving program of drill and instruction which began at 5 a.m. and continued for the next 17 hours and included up to 7 hours of marching. Sometimes the days did not end even there. On May 2, Jackson ordered his troops to sleep on their weapons and scheduled a full inspection for 1:30 a.m. Drilling came in different forms. There were marching drills, which taught the men how to walk together in formation and how to transform themselves from a marching column, two or four abreast, into a two-man deep battle line, and then how to reverse that action. The idea was to be able to move a 500 to 1,000-man regiment in an orderly way to, from, and around a battlefield. How to advance, how to retreat, how fast to march, how to dress ranks, how not to shoot at friendly troops. Weapons drills involved instruction in the 9 separate actions required to fire a musket. There was instruction on all sorts of other skills, too, from military protocol to making camp to the handling and cooking of rations. To help him with this, Jackson had procured the services of 10 cadets from VMI. Since there was virtually no training for officers in the South, who often sat up late at night in their tents reading printed manuals, the cadets' expertise was crucial to the early war preparations of the Confederacy. Within a week, Jackson had, to the amazement of local observers, quietly rebuilt the entire military operation at Harper's Ferry. Though the troops were still alarmingly green in many cases, the presence of a mastermind was visible in the changed conditions of the camp, wrote John D. Imboden, an artillerist from Stanton. Perfect order reigned everywhere. Instruction in the details of military duty occupied Jackson's whole time. Many of the militia officers who had left in a huff had thought better of it and had quietly returned, taking their places in the new volunteer army, now squarely under the command of the peculiar professor. What had emerged from the anarchy and disarray of that week was, in fact, a distinct and unusual style of command. It began with rigid discipline and adherence to the strictest military code. Jackson would not tolerate disobedience, insubordination, tardiness, or neglect of duty. Once or twice some willful young officer made experiment of resisting his authority, wrote Dabney, but his penalties were so prompt and inexorable that no one desired to adventure another act of disobedience. Punishments were doled out fairly and even-handedly, without passion or prejudice. Duty was duty. You shirked it at your own peril. And there was nothing personal about what happened to you, arrest and the guardhouse, if you did. Jackson, the new Jackson anyway, was all about scrupulous honesty, meticulous accountability, and cool professionalism. Soldiers quickly learned that quiet and unconversational did not mean irresolute. Everyone who had known him before noted the change. It occurred to us at the time that Jackson was much more in his element here as an army officer than when in the professor's chair at Lexington, wrote John Giddings, a former student who saw him in Harper's Ferry. His manner had become brusque and imperative. His face was bronzed from exposure. His beard was now of no formal style but was worn unshorn. He was already a very different creature from the professor he had been just a few weeks before. He had discovered a new competence, something he had never done before on this scale but was exceptionally good at. The men could feel it, and perceptions changed. The martinet's obsession with petty detail now came to be seen as evidence of an iron will. The only moments of relaxation we enjoyed were those we spent at mealtimes, but here we were met by the grave, solemn countenance of our commanding colonel, wrote recruit Charles Grattan. All were afraid of him, for none knew how kindly and genial a heart beat in his bosom. We ate, silent as mutes, ever and anon casting a healthy eye upon the colonel to see if he ate like other men, or bolted raw meat and gnawed bloody bones. Men who performed their duty to Jackson's specifications quickly discovered the other side of their commander. He was a rigid disciplinarian, yet as gentle and kind as a woman, wrote Imboden. He was the easiest man in the army to get along with pleasantly, so long as one did his duty. He was as courteous to the humblest private who sought an interview for any purpose as to the highest officer in his command. As an instructor, he was patient, forbearing, and tolerant of mistakes, provided his students were trying diligently to learn. Jackson proved to be good at pure logistics as well. After his arrival in Harper's Ferry, he'd been tasked by Lee with the removal of the rifled musket fabricating machinery from the former Federal Armory to Richmond. Within a week, Jackson had informed an amazed Lee that 2/3 of it had already been moved. A remarkable feat, considering that the complicated machines and their water-powered gearing had to be carefully dismantled before shipment. When he discovered that a wagon shortage had occurred because local merchants were paying twice the government rate, he seized the rolling stock. Local businessmen screamed in protest. Jackson ignored them. Unwilling to wait for Richmond to ship him the ammunition cars he wanted, he put blacksmiths and carpenters to work, converting commercial wagons to caissons. Impatient with the military bureaucracy on his requisition of horses, he dispatched his quartermaster to Horsey, Loudoun County, to impress or purchase them. Realizing that Confederate railways were low on rolling stock, he conceived and carried out an ingenious plan that siphoned off locomotives and cars from the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, an important Union lifeline to Washington and points east, and took them south into Virginia. By May 11, Jackson had seen his command grow to 4,500 soldiers, and his transformation of the large, disorderly encampment into the rudiments of an effective military force had not gone unnoticed. Lee was certainly aware of it. "I am gratified at the progress you have made in the organization of your command," he noted in a letter to Jackson on May 9. By May 21, Jackson would have fully 8,000 men, 7,000 of them armed, a number that included infantry and cavalry from Virginia, Mississippi, Alabama, Kentucky, and Maryland. They were still woefully under-equipped. "Words cannot express to you our deplorable condition here," wrote Major Kirby Smith on May 29 in a blast directed at his inept state government. "We are unprovided, unequipped, unsupplied with ammunition and provisions." In Harper's Ferry, as in the rest of the South, soldiers drilled in whatever they could muster, frock coats, swallowtails, jackets, and shirt sleeves. They carried their own carbines and fowling pieces until someone put an official weapon, likely a smoothbore musket, into their hands. Indeed, Jefferson Davis was still complaining to Brigadier General Joseph Johnston more than a month later, "I have not arms to supply you." In spite of that, Jackson's sheer organizational prowess inspired plenty of optimism. A report from an inspector general of the Army in late May was surprisingly upbeat. He pointed out shortages of clothing and equipment, inadequate ground for drilling, and the rawness and inexperience of the soldiery, but the inspector also noted that a fierce spirit animates these rough-looking men, and credited Jackson with assembling force enough here to hold this place against any attack. While Jackson was laboring to create a fighting force, making do with a scant few hours of sleep each night, he also managed to write a steady stream of affectionate letters to his wife, expressing his love and advising her on such matters as closing up the house, finding places for the slaves, and moving to her parents' house in North Carolina. "I just love my little businesswoman," he wrote. "Let Mr. Tebbs have the horse in Rockaway at his own price. And if he's not able to pay for them, you may give them to him, as he is a minister of the gospel. My habitual prayer is that our kind Heavenly Father will give unto my darling every needful blessing." He wrote of his military progress, too. "I am strengthening my position, and if attacked, shall, with the blessing of Providence, repel the enemy. I'm in good health, considering the great amount of labor which devolves upon me, and the loss of sleep to which I'm subjected. Colonels Preston and Massey have been of great service to me. Humanly speaking, I don't see how I could have accomplished the amount of work I have done without them. Oh, how I would love to see your precious face." J. Jackson enjoyed other less visible successes as well. He had, as it turned out, an exceptional eye for talent, particularly when it was attached to sober, hard-working Christian men. He had assembled the core of what would become one of the most talented staffs in either army. John A. Harmon, a loud, profane stagecoach operator from Staten, would become one of the most effective quartermasters in the Confederacy. Wells J. Hawks, a stagecoach builder from Charlestown who had been one of that community's leading citizens, became chief commissary, the man in charge of the food. The brilliant Hunter McGuire, a doctor destined for national prominence after the war, who was so young-looking that Jackson checked his credentials, became medical director on his staff. Finally, there was the whip-smart Alexander S. Sandy Pendleton, not yet 21, and the son of William Nelson Pendleton, the Episcopal rector in Lexington, who became Jackson's chief of artillery. The highly competent Pendleton quickly became one of Jackson's favorites, starting out as an ordnance officer and ending up as assistant adjutant general, the chief administrative officer, and doing a good deal of the critical military work on Jackson's staff. Jackson would have some 40 staff officers in his Civil War career, but these four would always remain at the heart of his operations. Jackson was, moreover, blessed with not one but two exceptional cavalry officers. There was James Ewell Brown Stewart, known as Jeb, a loud, joyous, irrepressible 28-year-old West Pointer who had spent his previous military career with the mounted rifles and cavalry in the West. He was an odd combination of flamboyance and puritanically strict personal habits. He wore oversized gloves, a yellow sash, and a feathered hat, went about singing and reciting poetry, and practiced a devout form of Christianity. Implausibly, considering how utterly different they were, Stuart and Jackson became close and even affectionate friends. Stuart was the only man in the army who could make Jackson laugh, the only one who could kid him and get away with it. There was also the 37-year-old Turner Ashby, a born leader of men who was almost recklessly brave and already a legend in his home state of Virginia. He had courtly manners, a flowing beard, and while sorely lacking in administrative skills, had astounding abilities as a rider and fighter. He was perhaps the purest example of the South's early overwhelming dominance in cavalry. Jackson's earliest personnel crisis involved both men. It was brought about by his own appointment of Stuart as head of cavalry. Facing an incipient revolt by Ashby, Jackson settled the matter by splitting the cavalry command in two and preserving the loyalty of both men. Stuart and Ashby would loom large in Jackson's future campaigns. So would a smallish, gaunt sorrel gelding that Jackson acquired for his wife during his Harper's Ferry posting and named Fancy. The horse turned out to have extraordinary endurance, a gentle rocking gait that Jackson liked, and the ability, later on, to doze peacefully in the middle of the hottest fights. To everyone else in the war, the horse was known as Little Sorrel. He became Jackson's principal mount for the rest of his life. The point of all this frenetic organization and reorganization was, of course, defense against the Northern invasion. Harper's Ferry was not only the South's northernmost military post, a knob jutting into the sovereign lands of Maryland, it was also a gateway to the Shenandoah Valley, the long, mountain-walled corridor that sat on Washington's western flank, and to the still-disputed lands of northwestern Virginia. But the town's main strategic value was as a transportation hub. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, the largest railroad network in the United States and a key lifeline to Washington, ran through it, and the 185-mile-long Chesapeake and Ohio Canal hugged the banks of the Potomac just across the river. Harper's Ferry was also one of the least defensible strategic sites in Virginia, if not the entire South. The problem was classically military. The town occupied conspicuously low ground. There were large mountains on three sides of it. Artillery placed on those heights could annihilate within hours whatever army was camped in the town. With troops and guns enough to occupy those heights, of course, Harper's Ferry could be held. But Jackson had nothing like that. There was the thorny problem of political geography, too. Maryland was a slave state that had not seceded. But the belief persisted that it might yet secede. Indeed, many Southerners believed that it would, meaning that any actions that might annoy Marylanders, such as military occupation of their lands, was thought to be a bad idea. The highest of the heights overlooking Harper's Ferry, as it happened, were on the Maryland shore of the Potomac. On May 6, Jackson, who seemed unimpressed by such political considerations, wrote Lee that he had occupied the Virginia and Maryland Heights and was fortifying them. Lee, as President Jefferson Davis's chief military advisor, responded immediately and with some alarm. "In your preparation for the defense of your position, it is considered advisable not to intrude upon the soil of Maryland unless compelled by the necessities of war." As it happened, at that very moment, Maryland was objecting strongly to the Union's invasion of its sovereign land. Might not Maryland consider Jackson an invader as well? But Jackson, an artillery officer who understood the tactical implications of his position, was pushing ahead on his own. He wrote Lee on May 7 that he had finished reconnoitering Maryland Heights and had determined to fortify them at once and hold them, as well as the Virginia Heights and the town, be the cost what it may. Be the cost what it may. In case he had not made himself perfectly clear, later in the same letter he stated, "I am of the opinion that this place should be defended with the spirit which actuated the defenders of Thermopylae." His reference was to the 480 BC battle in which 7,000 Greeks held off 100,000 or more invading Persians for 7 days before succumbing. Jackson's carefully chosen image is strikingly bloody, epic, and absolute in a war that had seen very little bloodshed. On May 9, Jackson wrote Lee again to report that he had placed 500 troops on Maryland Heights, prompting this scolding retort from Lee. "I fear you have been premature," he told Jackson. "The true policy is to act on the defensive and not invite attack. If not too late, you might withdraw until the proper time." Lee also pointed out the political repercussions of Jackson's rash moves. "Your intention to fortify the Heights of Maryland may interrupt our friendly arrangements with that state, and we have no right to intrude on her soil unless under pressing necessity for defense." In any case, it was too late. The troops would stay. But Jackson, after proving his mettle as an administrator, had now begun to build a reputation as something less desirable, an officer who was overeager and required close watching by a superior officer, and who, above all, needed to be reined in. In his movement into Maryland, he was completely at odds with the political climate in Richmond and with individual politicians, such as Jefferson Davis, who were deeply suspicious of him. This was, in part, Jackson's own fault. He was motivated by the belief that for the South to win against obvious industrial and numerical odds, it would have to win quickly. That meant hitting the enemy's green troops hard and soon, and not paying attention to such political niceties as state boundaries. That meant burning Baltimore and Philadelphia and making Northerners understand on a visceral level what this war was going to cost them. As early as the week after secession, Jackson had proposed to Virginia Governor John Letcher the idea he had mentioned in the letter to his nephew in January. A war of invasion in which the South would fly the black flag, meaning that all Union prisoners would be summarily executed. He even proposed to set the example himself. Though his plan sounded bloody, brutal, and unchristian, as Jackson saw it, there was clear and practical logic behind it. "He affirmed that this would in the end be the truest humanity," wrote Robert Dabney, "because it would shorten the contest and prove economical of the blood of both parties." This startling opinion he calmly sustained in conversation many months after, saying that since the Confederate authorities had seen fit to pursue the other policy, he had cheerfully acquiesced. But he still believed it. As for his then radical idea for a war of invasion, He was simply ahead of his time. By the second year of the war, Robert E. Lee would come to the same conclusion. He would eventually invade the North twice. Jackson's notion of total war, meanwhile, would soon define the entire conflict on both sides. The final campaigns of Union generals Grant, Sherman, and Sheridan in 1864 and 1865 were the fulfillment of Jackson's ideas. For now, however, they were seen as wildly aggressive, if not outright crazy. Chapter 5. A Brilliant Retreat. Jackson's one-man show in Harper's Ferry was not destined to last. Upper Virginia was too important, and Jackson was a mere colonel, a largely unknown quantity. On May 23, the 26th day of his command, Brigadier General Joseph E. Johnston arrived to replace him. The transition was perfectly characteristic of the scrupulous, by-the-book Jackson. Since he had not been informed by either Lee or Letcher of the change of command, Jackson politely but firmly refused to relinquish it, until Johnston, whose staff was dumbfounded by Jackson's stubbornness, could produce proof of his appointment. Johnston was not just any officer. When the war started, he was Quartermaster General of the U.S. Army and the highest-ranking officer to join the Confederacy. He was considered by several high-ranking officers on both sides, notably Longstreet and Sherman, to be the equal of Robert E. Lee. When warned by Johnston's staff officer Chase Whiting, Jackson's supercilious upper-class tutor at West Point, that he might be arrested for his behavior, Jackson stated calmly, "I consider my duty clear." He was never impolite. He even took Johnston on a tour of the camps. But he was insensitive to peer pressure, and he did not waver. Johnston, who managed to maintain his soldierly bearing and understood the military rule that officers should not relinquish command on verbal assurance alone, soon located a telegram with Lee's endorsement. Jackson immediately gave way with no hard feelings. For anyone who was paying attention, it was another signal that Jackson was not like other officers in the Confederacy. Though he was clearly ambitious, he would not extend even this small, rule-bending courtesy to one of the Confederate Army's most important officers and the man who would be in a position to promote him. Johnston, meanwhile, brought a radically different approach to the defense of Harper's Ferry. Where Jackson had preached the spirit of Thermopylae, and as good as invaded Maryland to set his defenses, Johnston's first thought was to fall back. "This place cannot be held against an enemy who would venture to attack it," he wrote to Lee. He offered a lengthy list of reasons why this was so, including lack of men, lack of ammunition, the presence of a hostile populace, and an inability to guard river fords. Lee, who regarded Harper's Ferry as a critical part of his strategy in northern Virginia, protested strongly in a letter to Johnston, writing, "The abandonment of Harper's Ferry will be depressing to the cause of the South." Johnston immediately fired back, "Would not the loss of 5,000 or 6,000 men be more so?" On June 14, with reluctant approval from the Davis administration, and against Jackson's wishes too, though he did not air his objections, Johnston evacuated Harper's Ferry. His pretext was the presence of a large Union force in the town of Romney, 60 miles to the east. It would later turn out that no such force existed. Johnston ordered Jackson to arrange the evacuation, which meant taking with them whatever equipment and materiel they could, burning what they could not, and looking after sick men and military records. This included setting fire to much of the town and blasting to bits the magnificent 900-foot B&O Railroad Bridge over the Potomac. 3 days later, Jackson systematically destroyed the sprawling B&O Railroad shop complex. He hated doing it. All he could see was the destruction of key wartime assets. In spite of the awkward transfer of power, Johnston and his duty-obsessed subordinate managed to get along. Johnston appreciated Jackson's talents immediately, retaining him as commander of the Virginia regiments and thus making him his top lieutenant. Though he had insisted on retiring from Harper's Ferry, Johnston was anything but a coward. He had graduated from West Point in the class of 1829, ranking 13th out of 46 cadets, had fought with distinction in the Mexican-American War, where he was twice wounded, and in the Seminole Wars, and had attained a higher rank in the regular army than his West Point classmate, Robert E. Lee. Confederate general and war historian Richard Taylor pronounced him the beau ideal of a soldier, an officer who gained and held the affection and confidence of his men. It was under Johnston that Jackson, known to his men by the name he had been called at West Point, and the name he would be called for the rest of the war, Old Jack, saw his first combat experience as a commanding officer. On July 2, he was encamped with 2,300 men and four cannons north of Martinsburg, a town about 15 miles northwest of Harper's Ferry in what is now West Virginia, when he received word that Union troops had crossed the Potomac River and were coming toward him. Jackson, whose standing orders from Johnston were to retire if the enemy approached him in force, could not tell exactly how many soldiers he was facing, though he knew that a large Union force under Major General Robert Patterson had been camped on the Maryland side. So he decided to find out in the most aggressive way possible, conducting what was known in military jargon as a reconnaissance in force, an attack whose purpose is to make the enemy reveal himself. Issuing precise orders in a soft voice that carried an accent from the western mountains of Virginia, Jackson ordered one of his four regiments, the 5th Virginia, to advance accompanied by a single piece of artillery. The 2nd and 4th Virginia regiments were to act as reserves in a state of full readiness. The 27th Virginia loaded the brigade's baggage and equipment onto wagons. Less than half an hour after he had gotten the news from Stuart's courier, Jackson's men were on the move. The Federals were moving too. When Jackson's force of 380 advanced on them at 9:15 a.m. at a place called Falling Waters, Union troops were about 3,000 strong. Jackson swung his men immediately into action, sending one of his companies on a flanking movement to the right. "The enemy soon advanced, also deployed, and opened their fire," wrote Jackson in his battle report. His skirmishers returned fire, driving the enemy back. The Federals came on a second time and were again repulsed. But that was the end of whatever tactical advantage Jackson enjoyed. He was clearly outnumbered, and now he could see just how bad the mismatch was. Federal guns began to rake his position, while enemy soldiers appeared in a battle line that was two regiments wide, enough to flank and even envelop Jackson's small group. Jackson gave the order to fall back. Before he did, his battery chief, William Pendleton, who less than 3 months before had been the Episcopal rector of Grace Church in Lexington, fired a cruelly efficient volley of solid shot that, in Jackson's words, entirely cleared the road in front. Jackson handled the retreat masterfully. It was the first real sign of his talent as a field commander. He held his command together as it executed the difficult and nerve-wracking task, even for veterans, of falling back 3 miles under fire before an enemy that held an 8-to-1 numerical advantage. Under Jackson's calm, self-possessed guidance, he was on horseback in the middle of the fight. The regiment withdrew slowly and deliberately, constantly checking the Federal troops, who, Jackson wrote, were advancing through the fields in line and through the woods as skirmishers, endeavoring to outflank me. It was, in other words, a fight all the way. Throughout it, as bullets and shells buzzed about them, Jackson, seated on his horse and moving constantly in front of his troops, had seemed fearless. In mid-fight, he stopped by the side of the road to write a note to Johnston. While he was writing, according to an artillery corporal who witnessed it, a shot from a Federal battery struck centrally, 10 feet from the ground, a large white oak that stood in the fence corner close to Jackson, and knocked a mass of bark, splinters, and trash all over him, and the paper on which he was writing. He brushed it all away with the back of his hand, finished the dispatch without a sign that he knew anything unusual was going on, folded it, handed it to the courier, and dismissed him courteously. "Carry this to General Johnston with my compliments, and see that you lose no time on the way." In his first test, Jackson had performed well. By the tactical standards of the early war, he had done exceptionally well. He had conducted an aggressive reconnaissance in force, had inflicted damage on the enemy, and then, obeying the letter of Johnston's orders, had conducted a disciplined retreat, contesting ground all the way. He was so effective that Union General Patterson estimated Jackson's total strength at 3,500 men, 10 times what he actually had on the field. Most gratifying of all to Jackson was the performance of his men, all of whom he had trained personally and almost none of whom had seen combat before. "My officers and men behaved beautifully," Jackson wrote Anna. Then, lest it seem that he was giving them too much credit, he added, "I am very thankful that an ever-kind providence made me an instrument in carrying out General Johnston's orders so successfully." This was no figure of speech, no trope of the era. Jackson believed that he was merely God's instrument, a crude tool in God's hands. All credit for victory belonged to God and to no one else. He had also benefited from the brilliant debut of Jeb Stuart, whose Virginia cavalry had been instrumental in making the retreat an orderly one. At one point, Stuart and his men daringly swept around the Federal right flank and captured an entire company of Union soldiers, a neat trick considering how badly Stuart and Jackson together were outnumbered. "Colonel Stuart and his command merit high praise," Jackson reported. "And I may here remark that he has exhibited those qualities which are calculated to make him eminent in his arm of the service." Though estimates of the numbers of killed, wounded, and captured at the Battle of Falling Waters vary widely, it is likely that each side suffered several dozen killed and wounded, in addition to the 49 Union prisoners taken by Stuart and the 10 rebels captured by the Union. Johnston was quick to realize what Jackson had accomplished. He was a combat veteran, and knew a talented field commander when he saw one. On July 4th, he wrote the War Department in Richmond to recommend that Jackson be promoted without delay to the grade of Brigadier General. But General Lee had already come to that conclusion himself, in spite of whatever reservations his associates in Richmond had about Jackson's rash behavior. In a letter to Jackson, dated July 3, Lee wrote, "My dear General, I have the pleasure of sending you a commission of Brigadier General in the Provisional Army, and to feel that you merit it. May your advancement increase your usefulness to the state." Jackson was elated. "My promotion was beyond what I anticipated, as I expected it to be in the volunteer forces of the state," he wrote Anna, proudly enclosing the letters from Lee and Johnston. What he meant was that his commission no longer came from the state of Virginia. His appointment as Brigadier General was to something entirely new, the Provisional Army of the Confederate States of America. He would be a general in the Confederacy, an organization that was slowly but steadily assuming authority over the states. Still, not everyone in Richmond was convinced that his promotion was a good idea. When President Jefferson Davis announced it, according to one Richmond insider, it provided laughter among those who thought they knew him well. Jackson knew nothing about what well-dressed men in Richmond salons and offices were thinking. He knew only that he had come very far in a very short time, and he had no doubt that God had made it happen or that he deserved it. Though he did not say so, it must have thrilled him to realize that only 2.5 months had passed since he had arrived, unheralded, unappreciated, and without a commission in the teeming streets of Richmond. Chapter 6. Maneuvers, Large and Small. The real war was coming. There was no doubt about it now. It would be here with the summer's heats, and would be fought somewhere in the state of Virginia by large numbers of men, and the resolution would be Armageddon-like in its clarity. There was very little disagreement about that. "Everyone seemed to think one battle would settle it," wrote Confederate officer William Blackford. "And those in authority who had brought on all the trouble, who ought to have known better, thought so too. The world would be sorted out, and there would be glory in the sorting." Above all, nobody wanted to miss the show. Witness, then, the 1st Virginia Brigade, 2,300 men in four regiments, under the command of newly minted Brigadier General Thomas J. Jackson, restive in its camps in early July in the heretofore peaceful and prosperous town of Winchester, at the northern end of the Shenandoah Valley, 60 miles east of Washington, D.C. This is also known counterintuitively as the Lower Valley, because it is farther downstream on the Shenandoah River. The past month had not exactly been glorious. The men had been ordered, much against their will and that of their commander, to retire from their base at Harper's Ferry in mid-June. They had been warned in late June not to engage the enemy if the enemy was in force, had engaged him anyway at Falling Waters, and had retreated under orders to the hamlet of Darksville, just south of Martinsburg. They had waited there for a battle that never materialized, and then on July 7, to their anger and disbelief, they had retreated yet again under orders, this time into the safety of Winchester. There was a clear theme here. Flight. Joe Johnston's Army of the Shenandoah Valley was moving inexorably west and south. The action and glory, meanwhile, as everyone knew, almost certainly lay to the north and east. It seemed to be a war of maneuver, and they were losing it. Union Commander Robert Patterson, inching down upon them from the north with 18,000 men, was certainly of that opinion. Crowing about his occupation of Harper's Ferry and Martinsburg on the Virginia side of the Potomac, he observed that, "We will thus force the enemy to retire and recover, without a struggle, a conquered country." Even more unsettling, word had arrived that a Confederate force in western Virginia had been soundly beaten and its commanding general killed by a 34-year-old military genius and four-square Union hero named George Brinton McClellan. The men of Jackson's 1st Virginia Brigade had been told they were already greatly outnumbered by the Union forces in Maryland. Now, with the victorious Union army apparently running roughshod over the northwestern part of Virginia, it seemed likely that Patterson would be coming with even more men, which would mean more caution, more retreat. It all seemed quite dispiriting. Jackson, irritated and restless, chafing at this enforced passivity, could do nothing about it. "I want my brigade to feel that it can itself whip Patterson's whole army," he wrote in a letter, "and I believe we can do it." That was about the last thing Joe Johnston or Jeff Davis or anyone else was going to let him do. So Jackson's men settled, somewhat sullenly, into camp life, where they were relentlessly drilled by their stern commander and awaited whatever sort of war might descend upon them. They also discovered the first of war's horrors, the sort that affected both armies equally and would eventually claim two soldiers' lives for everyone lost on the battlefield. Disease. Epidemics of mumps, measles, and smallpox swept through the Valley Army in the late spring and early summer, adding to the misery already caused by the inevitable, intractable camp illnesses, diarrhea, dysentery, malaria, and typhoid. Jackson's brigade was especially hard hit by measles and typhoid. Men who had never seen a battlefield were already dying painful deaths, and the number of soldiers on the sick list in Johnston's army rose to a remarkable 1,700 as of mid-July, nearly 20% of his force. Much of the sickness came from the galling sanitary conditions in the camps. The mid-19th century had seen many technological advances, but they did not yet include an understanding of bacteria or microbes. One of the key causes of disease in camp was the contamination of the water supply from what passed for latrines, which were nothing more than patches of ground, usually next to a watercourse, that were covered with fresh earth once a week. But men with severe dysentery and explosive diarrhea often did not make it to the appointed area. And so the soldiers were literally eating, sleeping, and drilling in the murk of infectious germs. Diarrhea especially, which was also a symptom of typhoid and dysentery, was one of the major killers of the war. Even in the relatively controlled conditions of Richmond hospitals, more than 10% of all diarrhea cases resulted in death, usually from severe depletion of bodily fluids. Jackson, meanwhile, was getting used to the idea of command. His new rank had changed the fundamental nature of his relationship with the world around him. VMI cadets who had been his students, including those who had mocked and teased him, and former colleagues who now served under him, could feel it. Behind every word, order, or request now rested the full weight of a brigadier general in the Provisional Army of the Confederate States. His obsessions with duty and detail now, in the perilous life of a large army, took on a different cast. Jackson, taking it all in stride, ignored the heat and the dust, which were plentiful, and the epidemics that were engulfing his tents, which included fleas, and ordered 6 drill sessions per day, punctuated by camp duties, roll calls, and meals. He did not limit himself to daytime work. The men marched at night, too, often for half the night. "Jackson is considered rigid to the borders of tyranny by the men here," wrote one captain in his brigade. But that same captain also said he believed that Jackson enjoyed the entire confidence of his command. Jackson, in turn, was immensely proud of them. As many of his soldiers noted, then and later, as hard as Jackson could be, he was also solicitous of his troops' welfare, sometimes almost motherly in his concern for their well-being. He was, as any of his friends from Lexington who knew him well could tell you, a strange mixture of sternness, severity, and deep kindness. What his wife, who saw him clearly most of the time, called this mingling of tenderness and strength was on display in a remarkable letter he wrote to one of his officers who had requested an extension of a furlough to visit gravely ill and dying family members. "My dear Major, I have received your sad letter and wish I could relieve your sorrowing heart. But human aid cannot heal the wound. From me you have a friend's sympathy, and I wish the suffering condition of our country permitted me to show it. But we must think of the living and of those who are to come after us and see that with God's blessing we transmit to them the freedom we have enjoyed. What is life without honor? Degradation is worse than death. It is necessary that you should be at your post immediately. Join me tomorrow morning. Your sympathizing friend, T.J. Jackson." His tenderness was very real, but it was also merely a sentiment. He would not allow it to interfere with what he considered to be his duty, and he would not budge in his insistence that the officer leave his stricken family. The men were getting used to his idiosyncratic ways, too. Jackson was no less eccentric than he had been at VMI, though his behavior was now on display in a much larger arena before thousands of men. He had his peculiar way of walking, his peculiar, ungraceful way of riding Little Sorrel, who seemed to be an extension of his personality, his dirty uniform and odd way of wearing his hat so that you could barely see his eyes, and his tendency to walk away abruptly in the middle of a conversation. He dined on cornbread and water, slept on the floor of a good room, in a house with little or no furniture in Winchester, though he also found that he liked sleeping outside, and spent several weeks sleeping outdoors on the ground, saying that it agreed with me well except when it rained, and even then it was but slightly objectionable. And, of course, he prayed and read his Bible, and consecrated every act of his life, every thought he had, to God. He did this consciously, every day. The blessings of his life, and in the month of July in the year 1861, Jackson believed he was in a high state of grace, all came from the hand of God. At least part of his devotion involved reminding himself constantly of just that. Some 60 miles away across the valley, through the towering ramparts of the Blue Ridge and the river-crossed lands of the Piedmont, the enemy was busy preparing for the war that the northern newspapers, with rising shrillness, were demanding. The central and somewhat bizarre characteristic of the war was that the capital cities of the two enormous nations, the Confederacy alone encompassed 750,000 square miles and 3,000 miles of coastline, were just 90 miles away from each other. And so, while recruits since mid-April had been swarming into large towns and cities across the country, in places such as St. Louis and Columbus and Atlanta and New Orleans, organizing themselves into regiments and brigades to fight the war across a broad front. The inescapable reality was that the first big fight was going to be, had to be, close to the power centers of the two nations, if only because losing one capital or the other would likely end the war almost before it started. On to Richmond was the battle cry in the northern newspapers. It was a catchy slogan and communicated a simple idea. Richmond, an easy and close target, would fall, and the South would lose whatever credibility it had as a military power, both at home and with such potential allies as France and England. Peace, on Union terms, would follow. Thus, by mid-July, a mere 3 months after the surrender of Fort Sumter, three Union armies confronted three Confederate armies in the Virginia Theater, along the most likely routes of invasion. Across the Potomac River from Washington camped a Union army of 35,000 men, commanded by Irvin McDowell. Facing it, some 30 miles to the west, at a strategic railroad junction called Manassas, was a Southern army of 20,000, commanded by Pierre-Gustave Touton Beauregard. To the west, in the Shenandoah Valley, Joe Johnston's 11,000 at Winchester faced Robert Patterson's 18,000, and on the Chesapeake Bay coast, at Fortress Monroe, John B. Magruder's 5,000 Confederates squared off against Benjamin Butler's 15,000. Thus, the underdog Confederacy began the war outnumbered and outgunned at every point in Virginia, 64,000 to 36,000. But there was plenty of reason for hope. Though the war had barely begun, the South had already found in Beauregard a hero for the ages. A 5-foot-7-inch bantam with an erect military carriage, piercing eyes, and a magnificent Van Dyke, he was a Creole from an important family in Louisiana. Like many other high-born sons of the South, the army had seemed a natural vocation. He'd attended West Point and performed splendidly there, graduating second in the class of 1838. In the Mexican-American War, he had served as an engineer on General Winfield Scott's staff, alongside Robert E. Lee and George McClellan. At the Battle for Mexico City, he was wounded three times on the same day and finished the war with the brevet rank of major. For the next 13 years, he mostly rebuilt and repaired forts in the South. In January 1861, he assumed the superintendency of West Point, only to be asked to resign soon afterward because of his pro-secessionist sentiments. All that gave him a record as accomplished as most officers in either army. But what made the dapper little man with the hair-trigger sense of dignity famous, indeed an instant legend, was the Battle of Fort Sumter. It was Beauregard, as commanding officer in Charleston, South Carolina, who had demanded the surrender of Union troops. And it was Beauregard who had ordered and supervised the 34-hour artillery attack on the fort. It had not been his idea to shell the fort, and in the battle that followed, the only casualty was a Confederate soldier who bled to death from a misfired cannon. And indeed, the fort he was pounding into submission was, for all practical purposes, defenseless, and was about to run out of food anyway. Virtually any officer could have given the same orders. None of that made any difference, nor did the fact that Beauregard was not an especially engaging personality. The war was commenced, and Beauregard, the brave and audacious soldier who had ordered the first shot, was an instant hero. The Southern press portrayed him as a Napoleonic figure. That part was hard to miss in a compact, French-speaking soldier with grand ambitions. And when he traveled north in late May to assume command of the Army of the Potomac in front of Washington, throngs turned out to meet his train, cheering rapturously. When he arrived, Carolina troops who had served under him roared, "Old Borey's come!" The North, as yet, had only McClellan to pit against Beauregard, and he was off in the mountains of western Virginia, still largely unknown. Beauregard's opposite number, commanding the Union forces in front of the Capitol, was Brigadier General Irvin McDowell, an army lifer who had never actually commanded troops in combat. A large, plain-looking man with a doughy countenance, a large, square head, a square jaw, and a squarish beard to go with it, He had, like so many general officers in the war, attended West Point, where he graduated in 1838, 8 years before Jackson. His subsequent career had been spent on various military staffs, starting as an aide-de-camp in the Mexican-American War and ending in the War Department in Washington, where he served under Winfield Scott and Joseph E. Johnston, among others. Though he had pursued a solid, unspectacular career, he was earnest, intelligent, self-confident, and politically well-connected, most notably to Lincoln's Treasury Secretary, Salmon P. Chase. On May 14, 1861, McDowell, still a brevet major, was vaulted over many officers who were superior in rank and length of service, and made brigadier general. Soon he was given the most important command in the Union Army. He was in many ways a hard man to like, stiff, formal, and aloof, a poor listener who often drifted while others were speaking, unless the subject was fishing. He had a singular inability to remember names and faces. Even his friend Salmon Chase thought him a bit distant. "He is too indifferent in manner," Chase wrote. "His officers are sometimes alienated by it. There's an apparent hauteur." No, that is not the word. "Rough indifference" expresses better the idea in his way towards them that makes it hard for them to feel any warm personal sentiment towards him. He was a strict and unforgiving disciplinarian, which made him unpopular with the volunteers. He was also a massive eater, so much so that while in the midst of a meal, he often paid little attention to the people around him. At dinner, he was such a gargantuan feeder and so absorbed in the dishes before him that he had but little time for conversation, wrote a Union officer who attended formal dinners with him. While he drank neither wine nor spirits, he fairly gobbled the larger part of every dish within reach. Nevertheless, he would be the one to fight the big, definitive battle that would decide the fate of the nation. If McDowell seemed to be a minor sort of man in talent and career achievements, his immediate supervisor, Winfield Scott, was in most ways larger than life. Scott was the nation's preeminent soldier. He was, as it happened, actually older than the United States itself. Virginia-born in 1786, he had been a hero as a young man in the War of 1812, became a general-in-chief of the U.S. Army in 1841, and was the chief architect of its stunning victory in the war with Mexico. He ran as the Whig Party candidate and lost in the presidential election of 1852. He was everyone's idea of what a general ought to look like, a massive 6 feet 5 inches tall, with splendid side whiskers and hair swept back from a noble brow and dapper in his blue uniform. He was, as his subaltern said in Mexico, a magnificent man. But by the time the war began, those days were over. He was 74 years old now. In addition to his towering height, he was now massively, almost comically fat. He lurched about, had trouble standing for long periods of time, and could no longer ride a horse. He was vain and prone to fits of temper, as he had always been. Still, after Robert E. Lee turned Lincoln down for the job, there was no one else in the North with quite Scott's military stature. And it was Scott who, quite sanely and reasonably, as a military man who knew what war was all about, had come up with a grand scheme for a relatively bloodless victory. Derided in Northern newspapers as the Anaconda Plan, the metaphor was nonetheless apt. The idea was to envelop the Confederacy from without, blockade its Gulf and Atlantic ports, and send a force of 60,000 men down the Mississippi to choke off its commerce and, in effect, split the South in two, bottling it up in what could then be a useless and valueless sea of cotton. The idea was to squeeze the South to death. It had merit, and indeed would be revisited by the Union later in the war. But Scott's plan would take time. Time to build or acquire ships, time to train troops for the Mississippi expedition, and time was something no one seemed to have. Passive, slow-burning solutions were not what the Times or the bellicose press of both sides called for. Public opinion in the North was overwhelmingly in favor of crushing the rebellion now. Lincoln himself favored an immediate invasion. There was even a timetable of sorts, if one believed what one read in the papers. On June 26, Horace Greeley's influential New York Tribune began running an editorial page slogan that